Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. The Neo-Luddites anxiously wring their hands over the supposed erosive effects that new electronic forms of communication and affiliation have on community. They point to net porn, cyber-stalking, and the greater likelihood that someone will flame someone else online than if they were face-to-face. They conjure images of a nation of pudgy, pasty-faced geeks with no social skills committing random acts of cyber-terrorism. But for every new form of cyber-assisted isolation or misanthropy, there are new forms of cyber-community. Global listservs and chat rooms that allow people with the most obscure interests to become good friends. Websites on the left and right that become the foci of new distributed, acephalous forms of political organization. Writers' circles that read one another's electronic copy. Elementary school websites that allow parents to monitor their children's academic progress and regularly communicate with teachers. Social scientists have been studying online community and identity for many years now, developing many new subdisciplines. But few theoreticians have the breadth of interests of Dr. Steve Mizrak. Dr. Mizrak is an anthropologist and author of Cyber Anthropology, Exploring the Cultures of Technology. He's also a video artist and investigator of unexplained phenomena. In his essay, Technology and Transgression, Mizrak concludes, "People who are Luddites and who are seeking social change should stop and reconsider their position. In order to stop technology, they may be threatening one of the most important sources of emergent novelty and greatest weapons against domination that the human race has. These subcultures," that he examines in the essay, "show that technology is more than just a hegemonic force. It's also a schismatic one, a prismatic one, constantly opening up possibilities that the powers that be never wanted. This is why they've always sought to tightly control technology, but people who are interested in transgressing against the constraints that people suffer under in post-industrial society shouldn't seek to reverse or halt technology. Rather, they should put it to new, unwanted, unexpected, and ironic use." Dr. Mizrak, you've said that your cyber anthropology is not just the study of technology and network communities, but also a radical cyborgian or cyberpunk approach. Is that approach defined by how people take over technology for expressive and liberatory uses?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things is if you examine the history of technology and maybe more particularly communication technology recently, this is sort of an underlying thread or golden braid that I find particularly interesting. I mean, to me, the internet itself is exemplary of this in the sense that this was a network which really was originally designed primarily for military purposes. I mean, basically, it was to assure that the nation's nuclear missile facilities would still be able to communicate with each other after a nuclear attack. But what's interesting is almost immediately when the internet was still DARPANET, one of the first communication systems or listservs that was set up on it was SF Lovers, for people who were fans of science fiction literature. And obviously this was a completely novel and unexpected usage of a network which had, again, primarily been designed for military communications. But immediately, even after being created, people, I think, were already putting it to uses that I think the designers had never really anticipated. To me, this is something about technology that I think, I mean, it's particularly true, obviously, if you look in the 20th century, but even in earlier periods, people are always finding new and interesting ways to use technology in exactly counter-hegemonic purposes. I think that this is something that research shows over and over again.
In your essay, The Technology and Transgression, you talk about transgressive technocultures, and I just wanted to have you touch on a couple of those. One of those that you mentioned was the radio underground, which I guess I see myself maybe as a part of here in public community-supported radio. Can you talk a little bit about how radio is a part of this?
Yeah. Well, obviously, to me, the radio underground is actually really two distinct communities. On the one hand, there are people who I think are using radio production and broadcasting in kind of transgressive ways. That would, of course, be the radio pirates. And, of course, who exactly these people are, What's interesting is on the one hand, you have what's explicitly defined as pirate radio, which are these illegal broadcasts of unlicensed broadcasters. Then there's a somewhat more nebulous area, obviously, of what would, I guess, be called micro-broadcasting, where you have people like the founder of Black Liberation Radio, also Stephen Dunifer of Radio Free Berkeley, which is basically a community-oriented approach where the goal isn't even really to transgress against commercial radio and do what the other commercial radio stations are doing, but instead to broadcast an explicitly local or community-based radio signal, which is something which is completely different. These people are also frequently called radio pirates, even though I don't think they really are in the same sense as the other pirate radio broadcasters. And so obviously you have that. You have pirate radio and then what I guess I would call micro-broadcasting. And then the second category would be people who are involved in clandestine radio listening. And, of course, this would be people, I guess, who scanner enthusiasts, people who scan the shortwave bands and so on. And I guess it's sort of strange to think of listening as a transgressive activity, except obviously it is once you start listening to the things that you're not supposed to be listening to. For example, the scanner enthusiasts like to scan through the various military radio frequencies, and in fact a lot of the speculation about what's going on at the so-called Area 51 is based on this subculture of people who daily kind of flip through the various radio frequencies of the jets and so on in order to try and divulge information. And then obviously in the shortwave category you have the people who are sort of interested in listening to the various political clandestine stations. And then of course there's the endless debate over the so-called mysterious number stations, these shortwave stations which do nothing but transmit certain numeric frequencies over and over again. There's endless debate about exactly what these things are. But I guess what's transgressive about listening to them is it doesn't seem like they're intended for the audiences that are listening to them. So,
musical transgressors, you talk about hip-hop and rave. And is this really very different? I mean, haven't new technologies, the electric guitar, isn't that an impact of technology on new musical culture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, the one thing is people tend to look at these phenomena just in terms of recent senses, but I think if you look back deeper into history, I mean, certainly electronic music, for example, there's a very fascinating, great film on Theremin, the creator, obviously, of this instrument, which is actually not played through physical contact, but instead you actually wave your hand, and by disturbing an electrical field, you actually create sound. Electronic music is far older than the 1990s. The use of technology to create new musical forms is also much older. Even though people are just now starting to focus on it as it developed in the 80s and 90s. I mean, obviously the use of synthesizers and so on goes back a long time. And certainly the other thing I think gets neglected is that there was a avant-garde movement even within what I guess would be almost considered classical music, in the sense that you have people like Karlheinz Stockhausen, for example, and other people experimenting with music concrete, electroacoustic music. I mean, the point is there are experiments with incorporating electronic technology into music that do definitely go back much further than what most people normally look at. So, yes, this is something with deep roots. The other thing that I find fascinating, obviously, is there's a counter-reaction to all this, and so you have MTV Unplugged, in which people are performing without amps or any electronic equipment. Yet on the other hand, nobody would be able to watch the performance if they weren't using an electronic technology, namely their TV set, in order to watch the performance. So I find that kind of fascinating. On the one hand, the performer is using no electronic amplification, but on the other hand, nobody would be hearing what they were playing if it were not for an electronic device, the television. So it's sort of strange that we have this counter-reaction. The other manifestation, I guess, is the sort of LP a fetish that I think's developed among some audiophiles who insist that somehow old-style, long-playing record albums have a sort of, I guess what they call an audio warmth that's not found among the newer digital technology. I mean, I don't know, I still have a record player and listen to my old records, and frankly, being rid of a lot of that hiss and distortion is actually quite welcome to me, but I guess maybe I just don't understand the countervailing point of view on this.
Is this an example of the thing that you write about, modern primitives and and the infusion of older attitudes, or is this just the Luddite reaction?
Well, yeah, right. There's two different kinds of responses to new technology. One, I think, is welcome and interesting, and then the other, in my opinion, isn't. Luddite rejectionism isn't interesting. On the other hand, sort of the modern primitive phenomenon of taking new technology and putting it to very old uses, you know, I guess if we think of sort of ritual activity maybe as one of the oldest behaviors of humankind, going back to cave art and the rest, certainly putting technology into those types of rituals and performances is doing something very old with something very new. Yeah, to me that's interesting because it's not rejectionism. It's actually taking technology and saying, hey, there's a long history of human exploration, and what's so wrong with taking these technologies and applying them to things that human beings have been doing for a very long, long time.
I'm speaking with Dr. Steve Mizrak. He's an anthropologist, author of Cyber Anthropology, Exploring the Cultures of Technology. The thesis that you wrote for your PhD was on the uses of technology on a Native American Indian reservation.
Mm-hmm.
What were they doing with them?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is I worked, I guess, as a sort of participant observer, perhaps more explicitly so than other anthropologists in the sense that I think I was sort of helping to facilitate the processes I was describing. But I worked at what was known as the Harry V. Johnston Lakota Cultural Center on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. And I was involved, basically, some of the things that the center was doing, which I thought were very interesting. They were attempting to audio record various traditional kinds of performance, powwow songs and so forth, and also were broadcasting their own radio program containing some of this performance and also discussing local issues, local politics, water rights, and so on. This program was called Wakpa Washte, basically good morning. And so they were broadcasting radio from the cultural center. There was also a video effort as part of the Wolakota Oral Histories Project. They were videotaping traditional elders and attempting to edit these into video programming that could be used in the local schools. And there also was some preliminary effort. I think where I participated most was in creating a website for the cultural center and in developing electronic commerce where people would actually be able to buy local indigenous artwork and crafts from the cultural center through their web page. So there had already been some work with radio and video and television before I got there, and I think as I was there, they started expanding into working with computers and the internet.
My in-laws just stopped by and for a week, and they came in their little camper. My father-in-law immediately hooked up his laptop and downloaded his email and started working on his various grants and things. The high-tech nomadism, this is something that Bruce Sterling has proposed is going to be a feature of our future, that as we become increasingly networked and then our organizations and the style of our work becomes more of a telecommuting kind of style, that people will begin wandering around and place will be less important than just your connection.
Yeah, sure. And if anything, this has a tremendous impact, obviously, on indigenous people who are already, I guess, have this wandering inclination. They were nomads before they were high-tech nomads. Obviously, they've been forced to live a settled existence for, you know, because of a variety of outside pressures for the last 200 years or so. But certainly, one of the things I actually argue in my dissertation is that indigenous people may be actually better adapted for this high-tech nomad lifestyle than the rest of us are, because they actually have a far longer history of being nomads and maybe more experience to draw upon. And the other thing, of course, about the ending of the importance of place, one of the reasons why I think this is so important for Native Americans, actually, is that living on an Indian reservation obviously is not an ideal environment for many Native people, because often, for obvious reasons, it's not often the agriculturally best land, although in some cases they have access to mineral resources. More often than not, the reservation is in a place where there isn't a lot of resources, and contrary to what many people believe, many Indian reservations are also too remote for them to really have very successful gambling enterprises. So, in fact, what do the reservations do for economic development? Well, the great news is along comes the internet, and suddenly they can participate in the information economy regardless of their location. It doesn't matter the fact that they live on a fairly remote, isolated reservation. Data processing can be done just as well by a bunch of Lakota Indians on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation as it could be done by a group of Pakistanis in Silicon Valley. The decentering of place, I think, actually offers indigenous people, especially indigenous people in the United States, kind of rather unprecedented opportunity.
One of the things that you write about in cyberanthropology as well is the metaphor that the human being and the human mind is a computer would be useful. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, that's been a very controversial notion among people who study consciousness, that the human mind is or is not hardware with some kind of software in it.
Well, see, now the problem is there's lots of different kinds of computers, and this is where I think that the point sort of gets lost. The computers that people are most familiar with, obviously, are serial digital computers that process information in a very specific way. Thinking of the mind in computer-like terms, ironically enough, doesn't necessarily lead to what I guess would traditionally be thought of as a, quote, mechanistic view of consciousness, in the sense that, yes, if you're going to think of the mind in terms of a steam-driven machine, like I guess Lemaître did back in the 18th century, then fine. It's just something that takes input, spits out output, and isn't something very complicated at all. On the other hand, thinking about the mind as sort of a digital processor, okay, capable of working in parallel, you know, and also, as we're starting to see, the interesting thing about neural networks is that they're able to evolve. Well, this is something clearly that the human mind also does. I guess what I'm mainly arguing is that analogizing the human mind to a type of digital processor doesn't necessarily reduce its complexity as long as the analogy is equally sufficiently complex. I mean, I think the problem with a lot of literature on AI is that it actually analogizes the brain and the mind to a very simple kind of computation, which I don't think has anything to do with consciousness at all. What I actually argue is that I think once systems become complex enough, there is some type of emergent process of self-emergent awareness. I think it could be the case that in an artificial intelligence, once it reaches a certain level of complexity, something like consciousness, similar to human consciousness, although not the same, because I don't think they're not biologically based. But the point is, consciousness is something that I think really emerges out of a variety of properties of the human mind, and to analogize the mind to a computer in the proper sense, I think, doesn't really reduce its mystery or its complexity, and doesn't make human beings into a simple machine in the sense that it's just something like the behaviorist thought in terms of just taking inputs and spitting out outputs. No, you know, computers can be marvelously nonlinear, complex, produce all kinds of unexpected things. Okay, it's in that sense that I also think that the human mind can be analogized to a computer. So
I'm speaking with Steve Mizrak. He's the author of Cyberanthropology: Exploring the Cultures of Technology. He's also an investigator of unexplained phenomena. How did you get interested in unexplained phenomena, and can you dilate on the term Fortean for us? What is a Fortean?
Okay, Charles Fort was a collector. Basically, what he did is he combed through the scientific journals of his day. I guess the sort of equivalent, maybe, you know, I think in those days scientific literature was a little bit different. But what he would basically do is he would comb through these journals and he would look for kind of unusual or unexplained events. One of the things that Fort particularly liked to collect were stories of things falling from the sky. So in fact, in some ways, that's almost become synonymous with Fortean, reports of fish, blood or red substances falling from the sky, frogs falling from the sky.
Which made an appearance in the film Magnolia recently.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fort particularly liked to collect those types of stories, although they were not the only type. And what he would do is, by collecting these stories, he would often point out that the explanations that scientists gave for them were fairly insufficient, in the sense that there was more an attempt to explain away the phenomenon than to attempt to acknowledge that it might actually be mysterious or unusual. So in other words, he noticed that wherever there was a fish fall reported, a meteorologist would frequently be trotted out to say that a whirlwind was responsible, even though, A, no one had sighted a whirlwind in the area, B, no one's ever proven, by the way, that a whirlwind actually has the ability to lift fish into the sky and then bring them back down at a distant point, and C, that there was any effort that any eyewitnesses were asked whether there was a whirlwind present in the area. In other words, the whirlwinds, sort of trotted out as what he would say in an effort to dam the phenomenon. In other words, to say, well, there's really nothing mysterious going on here. There's nothing interesting. It was all done by a whirlwind. And so what Fort did is he analogized those efforts to kind of explain away or dam mysterious or unusual phenomena. One of his books is called The Book of the Damned, again with the idea that almost like religion, science is damning these phenomena because it just doesn't want to deal with them. They're considered heretical. The idea was that he analogized this, obviously, to in the 18th century it was not uncommon for people who reported sightings of meteorites, as these people would often be called deluded or drunk or hallucinatory, because one of the leading scientists of the French Academy of Sciences at the time basically said, hey, stones cannot fall from the sky. What people are seeing is impossible. Therefore, we must explain away any reports of this type. And so what Fort was saying was that science seems to continue to do this. When confronted with the unexpected and unusual, there are often explanations that are trotted out to explain away the phenomenon, even though, as has often been pointed out, although we call this skepticism, in fact, it's very easy to be skeptical of these skeptical arguments, because although they're trotted out to explain away the phenomenon, it turns out when you really investigate it, they're inadequate. As I've said, no one's ever proven yet that a whirlwind can lift fish into the air and then have them rain down at a distant point. It's never been demonstrated scientifically, and yet people still use this as an explanation of these events.
It's interesting that you have this interest because, on the one hand, you're an advocate of a greater openness and embrace of technology and the liberatory, emancipatory aspects of technology. On the other hand, you're critical, as many anthropologists are, many social scientists in general, of the hegemonic paradigm dominance of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually people who are hostile to science in that particular way are also Luddites.
Technology often proceeds independently. There's plenty of things that are discovered in science that are never applied as technology, and furthermore, a lot of the technology that we're doing actually rests on no scientific investigation whatsoever. I mean, to me, my favorite example, of course, is aspirin. Everybody takes it, everybody uses it. Believe it or not, there still is not a consistent scientific biomedical model explaining the effects of aspirin in the body. Aspirin is a technology we use without fully scientifically understanding it. And I think there are many technologies like that. So really, what I guess, if I could try and attempt a kind of consistency in my position, what I believe in is the social construction of science, just as I believe in the social construction of technology. I believe that science is created, implemented, understood, disseminated through a network of social forces, just as I believe the same thing occurs with technology.
So. You used to work for the Union of Concerned Scientists and worked on energy policy for them. I assume you have some pretty choice things to say about the Bush administration's energy policy, which is, in a kind of weird way, it's kind of old school industrial rejection of the future. It's like, you know, who cares about what possibilities there are? Let's go back to coal.
Right. What are Bush's solutions to our energy problems? Is to go back to coal, go back to nuclear power, Basically, it gives very little money toward any sort of alternative energy research whatsoever. And the fascinating thing is, in the area of energy policy, when you ask people what the main barrier is toward implementation of renewable power, specifically, I guess, solar, wind, and so on, the general assumption is that, well, we can't use these technologies because they're more expensive than the ones we currently use. Well, what's the primary reason for that? We've been using coal for a long time, so we figured out how to use coal more cheaply. I would argue that if the same research effort and interest was put into, for example, developing solar power, I believe solar power could also be produced more cheaply and perhaps even on a competitive basis with coal. So the weird thing is, on the one hand, we have people saying, well, we can't use these alternative energy technologies because they're not as economically feasible. But then one of the reasons why right now I think they're not as economically feasible is not as much research has been poured into them as has been poured into the use of these other energy technologies. So, you know, the Bush administration, for example, has done very little in terms of renewing for a while. The Clinton administration did have tax credits for research into solar, wind power, and other renewables. And I noticed Bush has done very little in that area, as well as in funding research and development and conservation. I mean, obviously, the other part of the energy puzzle is not only just to figure out how to produce it more effectively, cheaply, and sustainably, but also, obviously, to build devices that also use it on the other end more efficiently and effectively. And it seems like research in both of those areas, you know, obviously, Al Gore lost the election. One of the things that Al Gore always said that I like was that, you know, technology and the environment are not necessarily hostile to each other. In fact, one of the side benefits of developing new technologies is that hopefully we can also make them cleaner, more sustainable, more efficient, better able to conserve resources and energy. So the great thing about technological development is it doesn't have to be antithetical to ecology and the environment. And one of the side benefits, as long as people are willing to investigate this, is that new technologies can actually benefit greatly in this area.
What are you working on now?
One of the things I'm looking at right now is the use of visual symbolism, actually, in the Elian Gonzalez case. Obviously, this is research that I'm well-suited to conduct because it all occurred right here in my backyard, basically. So one of the interesting things I'm looking at right now is what role did Photoshop, for example, and image alteration play in the political protests in this area? And, of course, what's fascinating to me is that within, I believe it was within 3 or 4 hours, everybody's familiar with the so-called AP press photograph in which they see this armed ATF agent. Of course, few people comment on the fact that the safety on his rifle is still in place, but obviously there's this image of this armed, helmeted ATF agent confronting Dalrymple and Elian Gonzalez in the closet. The boy is in terror, and he appears to be pointing the rifle at the two of them. Obviously, that's an image with a lot of power and resonance on its own. What really fascinated me was that within 4 hours of that image being disseminated over the AP press wires, it was being manipulated and used, put on posters and placards and so on, and protests here, but more interestingly, being altered. So people altered it so that the face of the ATF agent had been replaced with the face of Bill Clinton or Janet Reno or Fidel Castro. So what's fascinating to me is now one of the interesting things, I guess, about what you could call postmodern politics is that not only, obviously, I think images have always played an incredible role in politics, but I think what's happening with greater frequency is that electronically altered images are starting to play a role as well.
It's kind of the democratization of propaganda art.
Yeah, basically.
Hmm.
I mean, the interesting thing is, obviously, to some extent, I was not totally sympathetic with the political point of view of the critics of the decision to return the child and so on. But on the other hand, I'm not really passing judgment on them. What I'm really, in what I published about this recently, I'm mostly focusing on just looking at this as a process. In other words, without passing judgment on their politics, I'm just saying, look, this is an interesting new way in which image usage and manipulation is kind of being used within the political process. So
I've been speaking today with Steve Mizrak. He's an anthropologist, the author of Cyber Anthropology, Exploring the Cultures of Technology. He's also a video artist and investigator of unexplained phenomena down there in Florida. Steve, you have a website. You want to tell us the website address of that?
Sure, yeah. The URL for the site is www.fiu.edu/TildeMizrakS, M-I-Z-R-A-C-H-S. Okay, if you follow that link, you'll be on my main homepage. From that, there are actually several subpages that you can access. Probably of most interest to people who are listeners of the show will be the Cyber Anthropology subpage. My email address is Mizrachs, M-I-Z-R-A-C-H-S, at FIU.edu.
And if you go to Google or any other search engine, you can find quite a number of Steve's articles by typing in Steve Mizrak or Seeker One, which was
right.
your moniker.
Cyber name, yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.